Welcome to Camp Constitution Radio with your host, Hal Shurtleff. The show is heard on WBCQ The Planet every Monday and Thursday evenings at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can also pick up the show on our YouTube channel, Camp Constitution, and also Podomatic, podomatic.com, and just put in Camp Constitution, and you'll be able to hear the show, download it, share it, etc. It's brought to you by Camp Constitution, which, among other things, runs a week-long family camp. Our next year's camp has, we have not set a date as of yet. We should have a date next week. We're looking at several venues, and visit our website, campconstitution.net. Well, we have a guest on the line there. Steve, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Well, first off, I want to thank you very much. Yeah, I want to thank you for joining our show on very short notice. Steve Bias is the author of History's Greatest Libels, that challenges some of the great lies of history. And I'll read a little blip on the back here. You're still teaching at the Hillsdale Free Will Baptist College in Moore,
Yes, I am. The name has been changed to Randall University, but it's the same institution.
And you also are a regular contributor to the New American Magazine, which is an incredible magazine. It comes out twice a month, and I've been reading your articles. You've been writing for there about almost, 7 or 8 years now?
Something like that, yes.
Yeah, and I tell you, those articles are great resources. And you also, you have written a high school government textbook, two mystery novels, Digging Up Bones and Sooner Dead, and his work has also appeared in Tennessee Historical Quarterly, and you live in Norman, Oklahoma, with your wife, Donna. So, tell us a little bit about what I haven't mentioned here, a little bit about your background, and why did you write this book?
Of course, I've been teaching history either in high school or college since 1978, and I've always been a history buff. And over time, the more you read about history and then you hear what people think happened in history are not always the same thing. And specifically, what came to bother me was I would hear people make comments that I knew that they had picked up in the popular culture somehow, and they were myths. For example, the first chapter in the book is George Washington. It was a deist. And, of course, I go through and I show that he was a typical Christian of his day, that he was not of the philosophy of deism.
You made a very good point. Yeah, you made a great point. You mentioned that you had 11, there's 11 things here in the chapters. Washington was a deist, not a Christian. That's one of the myths. And then Hitler was a champion of Christianity. So where the left accuses Washington of not being a Christian, they say that Hitler was a Christian. I thought that was pretty ironic. You also
yes.
have a chapter, I think, we could talk probably half hour on each one, and we don't have the time. So let's just go into Washington being, that he was not a deist, and that Jefferson had children by a slave. Let's see what you do. We can at least refute these two first.
Okay.
So I think sometimes people hear the word deist, and they're not sure. They think it means an atheist or something. But a deist does believe in a God and a creator.
Yes.
But basically, God sort of set things up and just said, okay, folks, you're on your own, and walked away. So that you wouldn't pray to the God of the deist. You wouldn't answer prayer, wouldn't be interested in salvation and things of that nature. But they did believe that there was indeed a God.
Yes. It came out of the Enlightenment. People said it's obvious that there's a designer of the universe, but they didn't believe he intervened in daily human affairs in any way. Which obviously, if you're a Christian, you believe he did in a big way.
And it was interesting, too, because you can talk about Washington's writings, his prayers, and his numerous, not numerous, but his various executive orders as president that kind of back up that he was indeed a Christian.
Yes, that he could. I would say that I started off that particular chapter. I visited Mount Vernon, which I would encourage anybody to do, and I visited his tomb, and I was struck by the Bible verse on the wall which is a quotation of Jesus telling Lazarus, you know, the guy that died and he raised him from the dead, telling Lazarus' sister that I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And obviously a person who is a deist would not have that on their tomb, that George Washington sort of had instructions on what he wanted, you know, and everything. And obviously if he were a deist, he wouldn't have done that.
He also, there's a famous painting of him praying on his knees at Valley Forge.
Yes.
I'm sure you're familiar with that. And I think if my memory serves me right, that in the painting, which is not, it's hard to see, especially if you have a copy that's an online version, there's actually somebody kind of watching him from behind the tree. Is that correct?
That's my understanding that someone, you know, that's kind of one of those things that sounds mythical. You know, on the face of it, that you know, somebody would actually do that, but apparently there was someone that who said that he saw Washington doing that,
and as a result, they decided to support his efforts. There were some Quakers that weren't necessarily noted for their supporting war efforts, and that's the story I heard. That and that they decided to support the efforts to some extent. Anyway,
to some extent,
some of them did, And now I have, we actually, Camp Constitution Press reprints the famous farewell address, and you can talk about that. And now I know that he wasn't the author of everything in there. Obviously, I think Alexander Hamilton worked on that, and I think even James Madison. But there it's pretty clear when he talked about religion and morality being indispensable for a free people.
Well, the... You know, that was not, and that's not unusual among the founding fathers. You know, they, I think you can go to either extreme and, you know, that they were all, like they were all preachers. No, they weren't all preachers or anything like that, but you can't go to the other extreme. They were all a bunch of deists. I would say Thomas Paine would probably have been the only one that was an out-and-out atheist, you know, and... You know, and even Benjamin Franklin, who's probably the most worldly the founders, you know, he talked about praying to God to help the United States at the Constitutional Convention. So it was just the cultural consensus of the time, Christianity. It wasn't deism in the United States.
Right. Well, because Benjamin Franklin, when he called for prayer, didn't he say something to the effect that he's quoting from the Bible? He said, if a sparrow can't fall to the ground without God knowing, a great nation can't rise up. That doesn't sound very deistic to me. It sounds that he was either catering to the Christians in the audience, in the room, or maybe he really did believe that there is a God that answers prayer. And I would think the latter is the, and again, he wasn't.
Most likely, Yeah,
and didn't he also support some of the ministers, some of the revivalists at the time?
He was a friend of, and he was a printer for, and George Whitefield, who was the great preacher of the Great Awakening. And I don't know that he believed everything that Whitefield believed, but he certainly supported his ministry.
And he certainly didn't war against those who did have strong Christian convictions, as the American liberal or the leftist today does. I mean, they war viciously against Christianity.
Oh yeah, he certainly now, wouldn't have it. Yeah, any of them trying to say people shouldn't be on the Supreme Court or something because they believe in dogma
or
Christianity.
Or Congress. Now, you have I think this is another very important chapter. Thomas Jefferson had children by a slave. And I see the critics of this country, I will say, all your founders, they wore wigs to hide their syphilis scars, and they had wooden teeth, and they raped their slave women and all that kind of stuff. So, and most people today actually believe that Jefferson did have a relationship with Sally Hemings. So can you address that?
Yeah, that's a little more of a complicated story, but what that comes from is that they did a DNA study back in 1998, and where the average person, what they've heard is that DNA has proven that Jefferson had at least one child by his slave, Sally Hemings. But the doctor, Eugene Foster, who conducted the DNA tests, said the genetic findings do not prove that Thomas Jefferson was the father of one of Sally Hemings' children. We have never made that claim. My experience with this matter so far has left me that no matter what, how often I repeat it, it will not stop the media from saying what they want to. And I'm angered by it, he said. And so it's a misunderstanding of what DNA can prove and what disprove. And there's no, the tests that they did at that time were male to male to male all the way down to the present day of the time they did the test. And Thomas Jefferson does not have a male descendant that's descended from males all the way back to Jefferson. And so what they did is they took an uncle, I believe his name was Phil Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, and they did a descendant of that particular Jefferson. And of course that, and then they took a one of Sally Hemings' male children and his descendant all the way down, it's male to male to male, to the present day. And there was a DNA match in that it said that there was some DNA relationship with Phil Jefferson. And it was obviously not Phil Jefferson himself,
right?
Because he had died several years before this young man was conceived. So, you know, there are other Jeffersons around, and I can't remember how many it was, but it was several that could have been a potential father.
So it would have been a cousin. It could have been a cousin of Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah. Most likely Randolph Jefferson was Thomas Jefferson's brother because he was known to socialize with the slaves. And,
oh, yes. But, you point that out in the book, too.
Yes. But, you know, that's just what they do, you know, is people like to slander the founding fathers every chance they get. So they hear part of the story and they just repeat it.
Well, I think it's so what they want to believe things, too. You know, I'm reading a book about Ty Cobb, the famous baseball player, called A Terrible Beauty. And although he's obviously not as important as these other issues that you pointed out, there are people who just automatically have heard he was some kind of flaming racist that beat black people up every single chance he got. And while he did have a temper and got into fights, he didn't get into as many fights as most. And he had a very charitable attitude towards blacks, just the opposite. But people want to believe what they want to believe, or they keep hearing things all the time. They've never really checked the source out, but it sounds credible, especially if they, you know, an error of fact is repeated, it becomes the truth. And I think it's a terrible tragedy when, and I think even if we don't like the person, I mean, we have our issues too. Hey, I want to believe the worst about certain people, but if the truth is the truth, and I would say, look, I don't like this person, but I've defended some inaccuracies about historical figures whom I don't like, but I have to say what's true. This is the truth. Whether or not I don't like this person historically, but this is not what you're saying is not true. Now, I remember one particular sports writer who was into history, and he said, oh, the Mexican-American War was an illegal war. And I was on the radio with him, and I said, well, it was a declared war. Yeah, but we went to war against, stole this land from this poor country. So that's chapter three, libel number three. Can you address that? James Polk went to war against Mexico to obtain Texas.
Yeah. You know, and it's interesting that each one of these chapters was a result of an actual event in my life where someone said that thing.
Oh.
And this woman asked me when that happened that U.S. Got Texas from Mexico. Well, the United States did not get Texas from Mexico. Texas won a revolution in 1836 and won its independence from Mexico. And so it was almost a decade before the United States and Mexico went to war And so Texas was already independent of Mexico. But,
and I think you pointed out, too, the important aspect is that it wasn't just the white settlers that fought against the Mexican, the very corrupt Mexican government, but also the Native Mexicans themselves completely supported. And Texas had a tiny population, and it was really uncontrollable and ungovernable. So bringing didn't the Mexican government encourage the settlers, from the white settlers, to come into that country?
They very much did. Yeah, they gave a tract of land to Moses Austin and then his son Stephen Austin. And what they wanted was they could not get Mexican citizens to go up into Texas because of the Comanches. They were scared of them, which is understandable. But they thought if they could get these Americans to come down in there, that they would wipe each other out, and then the Mexicans could move into Mexico. Now, as it turns out, the Alamo, everybody's heard of the Alamo.
Yes.
And here again, there's so much historical ignorance that there's probably a lot of people think the Alamo was part of the Mexican War, but it was the Texas Revolution. But there were like 13 ethnic Mexicans that died in defense of the Alamo. The vice president of the Texas Republic was a Mexican, ethnic Mexican, De Zavala. And another thing that's interesting about all this, that Mexico actually offered to sell Baja California, that southern strip of below California, to the United States a few years after the Mexican War. So, they were in desperate need of money all the time. They sold the Gadsden land in what is now south of the Gila River in Arizona. They volunteered to do that in 1853, 5 years after the Mexican War. So all this stuff that U.S. President Polk is particularly the one I defend, the Mexican War came about. They were having disputes over various things, including the boundary of Texas, since Texas entered the Union 1845. So President Polk sent troops south to the north side of the Rio Grande River in the area that was in dispute between the United States and Mexico, and they were attacked by Mexican forces. And then the United States responded by declaring war on Mexico. The United States was attacked first by Mexico.
You know what's
it wasn't
interesting?
The other way around.
We ended up capturing the capital of Mexico, and they signed a truce. The war was over. And did we then annex Mexico to the United States? And did we execute all of the politicians and put half the civil public, half the people in concentration camps? No. Didn't we give them like $15 million or something like that? Some ridiculous stuff.
Yes.
It was a lot of money back then.
Yeah, it was.
It didn't sound like your typical brutal, invasion. Historically, once you capture a nation's capital, you now run that capital, right? But we didn't do that. Did we go back to the original borders, or the borders that we claimed were part of the United States?
Yeah, pretty much. And then, of course, California was its own deal. It was its own revolution that the United
the
States really didn't have anything to do with that at all. But, of course, then it became part of the United States.
I think it was the first that there was a Mexican general. And he actually ended up becoming one of the governors of California.
Yeah. So it's a little bit more complicated than, the simplistic morality play that people want to make it.
Now you have, there's so many good things here, but Columbus, this is libel number 8. Columbus was a monster who did nothing good. And Columbus Day is coming up in, a little more than a month and a week. And Vermont just was early, I think, last year. They did away with Columbus Day, and now it's Indigenous Day. And they want to take statues down of Columbus, and he was some kind of homicidal, genocidal maniac. So you did a great job of addressing that. So let's get into Columbus.
Okay. Well, you know, you've kind of outlined what the libel is about him. You know, people make just outlandish accusations that he was responsible for killing millions of indigenous people in the Western Hemisphere, which is totally absurd. You know, I mean, he had about 100 men. That would have been quite an achievement to do that.
Especially
and,
back then,
you know,
right?
He and people say, well, you know, he took diseases to the Western Hemisphere and all this kind of, well, and then he's held responsible for what happened after him, which you can't do that either. That's not fair. But Columbus's goal, he wanted to reach Asia, and he wanted to reach China, and because the Chinese rulers, the Kublai Khan, had told Marco Polo's family that if Christians would send missionaries there, China was open. And so Columbus was a very devout Catholic, and he wanted to get to China, convert China to Christianity, and combine forces against the Muslims who had taken over the Middle East, you know, in Jerusalem and so forth. So
these
people say that he was...
He hit Constantinople, Turkey.
Yeah, exactly. And so they had attacked them. And, you know, and a lot of people on the, you know, this is not one of my chapters, but so many people talk about, oh, the Crusades, you know, and they attacked the Muslims, the Christians in Europe. But that's, I guess what they're doing is they're starting history in the 11th century. You know, there's some history. There's 400 years before that, you know, where Muslims have been attacking Christians before there was this a reaction. It took 400 years before there was a reaction called the Crusades. And
I have a friend that is from the Sudan, which is now South Sudan, and he said that there were 800 years of Christian history, and when the Muslims took that country over, they totally obliterated any Christian history. It was just wiped it clean off the you know, off the map, so to speak. And that's the scary thing we see happening here, little by little. Oh, Robert E. Lee was a bad guy, got to take his statue down. Oh, George Washington, Tom. Here in Boston, we have this beautiful bas relief by August St. Gaudens of the 51st Regiment going off to battle. But that was a segregated unit with a white leader, and that's now considered racist. And there's a Bible verse on it. There's an angel over the soldiers. So they're saying, hey, this thing is bad too. So there's nothing sacred amongst these people. And you concede one thing, next thing you know, you're changing street names. And it's been doing this for a while. They're changing Washington Street to Malcolm X Street and things of this nature. And the Muslims, the group called CARE, the Center for American Islamic Relations, are leading the charge. Because that's what they do in their countries. They destroy, they take over the history. And, you know, we both love history, and you know what happens when you rewrite history. And not only that, but it's only one generation away from, you know, if you don't pass the baton of information, the culture, we've lost.
Yeah.
So I tell people that, you know, the same thing about Columbus, that in the Columbus, that did become a holiday until, what, in the 1930s?
Yeah, that's something that I went up, just hadn't always known that, you know, not recently. I didn't realize, of course, I was in grade school in the 1960s, and you know, when you're a kid, you think that has always been this way.
That's right.
I didn't realize at that time that this was only been around for about a generation, Columbus Day.
That's right.
And
But
it's really an attack
on
Western civilization, is what the attack on Columbus is what it's all about. And, you know, Christianity is a key part of that.
You mentioned diseases, too. At that time, they weren't aware of the how diseases were spread, and the fact that the Europeans had built up an immunity to a lot of these things, like smallpox and others. But we also got a few nasty things from the Indians, didn't we, like syphilis?
Syphilis, that killed, it didn't kill as many people in Europe as smallpox killed in the New World, but it killed a lot of people in a very short period of time.
So, I mean, one thing to the other. And weren't the Caribs, when you hear that word Caribbean, weren't
yes.
they actual cannibals?
That is correct. And, that is, like the conquest of Mexico. Of course, it wasn't called Mexico at the time, but Cortez, they were killing hundreds of thousands. The Aztecs killed hundreds of thousands of people for human sacrifice to their sun god. They ate them. They were cannibals. But yet, they're portrayed as somehow some paradise in the New World, that was going on.
And the thing
and,
about
Christianity
Cortez
was a bad thing to introduce.
A bad thing. But yeah, Cortez only had a small handful of people, but he had all the other Indians that were against the Aztecs. That's how he was able to conquer Mexico so
yeah.
quickly.
They were just looking for a leader, and, all
right.
it takes is a spark sometime.
And all that stopped. There was a movie that Mel Gibson directed. I can't remember. I saw the movie because he has a tendency to have his scenes are quite realistic. But it showed the priest ripping out the hearts of these people while they were still alive, and drinking their blood. And they did this for days on end. And these people who were captured, these other Indian tribes or groups of people, it was to be expected. It wasn't the concepts of mercy and compassion were not in that culture at that time. And people don't want to hear that, but it's the truth. That's a Jewish and Christian concept, not a pagan concept of mercy. And not to say that there weren't some, historically some Indian tribes and other groups that did show mercy at times, but for the most part, that was not much mercy. That was considered a sign of weakness if you were show mercy to your enemy. So now we have, this is the one, the French Revolution. Marie Antoinette, let them eat cake. And so many people, they just assume that was the case. And I remember a number of years ago when I was reading about that, I said, no, she never made any such statement.
No. And it would have been against her character to do so. From what I've read, I read several books about her before I wrote that chapter, and it would have been more in her character to give them her own cake, that was actually appeared like 60 years before Marie Antoinette even born. It was attributed to some other princess somewhere in Europe, and so we don't even know if that woman said it, that it's just something that was attributed to her. And, of course, the French Revolution is a model, for the Communist Revolution in Russia. They said it was. The Bolsheviks all praised the French Revolution.
That's right. And it was, and of course, people forget that her husband was an ally of ours. And if it weren't for that, we might have won eventually, but they were a big help to us, King Louis XVI. And we look like, oh, they were a bad guy. Really? Did the Revolutionary French send any help? No, they sent someone, Citizen Genet, to overthrow our country. That's what they were trying to do.
Yeah. He asked for the overthrow of George Washington. Yeah.
This is the fastest 30 minutes on radio here. We only get about a minute left. Where can people find out about this book, History's Greatest Lies? And it's a quick read. Something you might have to read and read and reread because it's about 128 pages. Where can people find if they want to get a copy of it?
Well, obviously, they can go to barnesandnoble.com or amazon.com. And I've sold quite a few there, and that's the easiest thing.
And also, if you go to the newamerican.com, your articles are archived there, plus you write on a regular basis. You can also subscribe to it, get the hard copy. And then also you have a Facebook page that people can go to your page and get some of your postings and what have you. So Steve Byas, correct?
Correct.
All right.
And that'll be,
it'll
be pretty easy to find me.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being a guest tonight. And with that, we'll say goodbye. We thank you for listening. You've been listening to Camp Constitution Radio with your host, Hal Shurtleff, on WBCQ The Planet. And until next week, may God richly bless you.